Hello, and welcome to the Virginia Voices program, The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, and today I'm coming to you from New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University, which in 2012 is having the first of its annual writer's workshops. Today we're going to be talking to a Yale alum who has returned to give a master class at the workshop and a reading. Her name is Julia Glass. Julia Glass is an author of 4 books, the first of which, Three Junes, won the National Book Award. Julia, thank you very much for joining us for this program today.
Thank you for having me on, Patty.
Your first book, the National Book Award, that all sounds so easy. Was it that easy?
Not at all. First of all, it wasn't published till I was 46, so there was a lot percolating inside me before that book came out. And, you know, here we are in New Haven, where I actually graduated from Yale in 1978, and I was a studio art major. I did not, although I wrote many, many term papers, I didn't study fiction writing here. And I only came to fiction writing in my early 30s after a decade of aspiring to be a successful painter. And I painted and I showed some of my work. But during that time, I also discovered that the art that moves me the most is literature. And it always has been. I mean, I've always been a lover of books. So then from the time that I started writing fiction, it took 7 years to publish my first short story and then another 9 years for Three Junes to be published.
I'm interested, though, in the actual transition from visual artist to word artist. Was there a precipitous event in your life that made you make the change?
You know, my personal folklore, and it's partly true, is that I was sort of felt hit over the head when I finished George Eliot's novel, Daniel Deronda. Now, Daniel Deronda is not my favorite book. It's not even the best of George Eliot's books. It's her last novel. It's rich and incredible, and I recommend it highly. But something happened to me when I read that book, mainly because of the female protagonist, Gwendolyn Harlow. I realized what the power of fiction really was. I think fiction is one of the greatest teachers of empathy in the world. And when I finished that book, here I was struggling as a painter, but making a living, by the way, with my word skills as a freelance editor, freelance. I was a pet journalist, of all things, proofreader.
A pet, P-E-T.
P-E-T. My first published work was a pet column in Glamour magazine. You know, to have a regular column be your first written, your first publication would be a dream to most people. To me, it was a way to pay the rent so that I could do my paintings. And how I got it is a very long story. I was just in the right place at the right time. And there are a lot of animals in my fiction, of course. I grew up with animals. Animals are a big part of my life. But anyway, all that time, I was reading like I'll never read again. I like to say that in my 20s, I read all the books I would have read if I'd majored in English at Yale. But I'd always been a book lover and a word lover. So in a way, the way I like to describe it is also that it's as if for all those years that I was so passionate about painting, I was an expatriate living in another country, and I was fluent in the language, but it wasn't my native language, and ultimately I had to come home, and I came home to language as my first language, if you could put it that way. And, you know, I felt during the transition when I realized that in order to write fiction, I had to stop painting because I had to make a living, and I couldn't do both of these, both kinds of art. It was a very tough period for me because I beat myself up over the thought that I had wasted all those years on the visual arts, that I ought to have been writing fiction instead of that, and what had I been thinking. And but it took me really until Three Junes was published to realize that all those years as a visual artist have very much determined the kind of writer that I am. And I am I'm a very visual writer. I love to go very deep into the psychology of my characters, into their motivations and their emotions. But the physical world in which they live is very much a part of my fiction, too.
Were you surprised at the reaction to Three Junes?
Well, you know, yes, I was. But that's not to say that one doesn't have grandiose, you know, particularly grandiose fantasies, particularly, I'd say, in the shower. But let me tell you, the biggest prize that I fantasized about was a wonderful prize, which, by the way, I have since been on the jury for, the Penn Hemingway Prize, which is for the best first work of fiction that comes out in a given year. That was my fantasy. Maybe I'd win. And by the way, I wasn't a finalist for that, so there you go. A lot of wonderful fiction came out in 2002, as, you know, it does every year. But the interesting thing about
including
Three Junes. But the interesting thing about that year is, as the judges of my National Book Award, or the head judge, said, it was the year of the thunderclap debut. It was the year that The Lovely Bones came out. It was the year that Jonathan Safran Foer's first novel, Everything is Illuminated, came out. It was the year that Ann Packer's first novel, The Dive from Clausen's Pier, came out. So what was interesting is that a lot of the books vying for the big prizes that might normally be taken by, say, John Updike or Jane Smiley or someone more established, a lot of the finalists for the big prizes that year were first and second works of fiction. And it was an interesting field of fiction, I guess you'd say. So, you know, again, it's sort of being in the right place at the right time. I mean, I have no illusions that another group of judges would have chosen a different book. So I feel very fortunate that way. But winning that prize did something that I wouldn't have anticipated. I'd say that the biggest surprise for me and the biggest delight was that it gave me an entree to meet so many writers I admired, because everybody was looking around like, who is Julia Glass? Three what? And I got to tour a little bit with Richard Russo. I could list a lot of writers I got to meet as a result. Michael Cunningham, John Casey, I met Jane Smiley. I got invited to a lot of literary events and to be a guest speaker over the course of the next year or so. I got to be flavor of the month. And I had never, because I didn't go through a formal fiction writing education, I had never had mentors, I'd never talked shop before, and it's like I found my tribe. And that was the greatest gift that prize gave me, along with readers.
To become part of a community.
Yes, that, and also just that the book reached a lot of readers I don't think it would have otherwise. And that's been amazing for me, is to meet readers as I go out touring and I visit book groups.
You mentioned the other night when you gave a reading at Barnes & Noble that you were on a panel with another writer. And I was surprised to hear you say that, oh, I learned he writes Julia Glass novels. Tell us what a Julia Glass novel is.
A Julia Glass novel is always about family, first of all. I am endlessly intrigued, fascinated, moved by the kinds of drama that take place within the families we have. And by that, I mean not just the families we're born into, about which we have no choice, but the families that we create, the families we create that fracture apart, that stay together, how our relationships with our siblings and our parents change as we go through different stages of life. I'm 56 years old, and I'm very lucky to have two highly functioning, independent-minded parents. They drive me crazy sometimes, but I love them both very much. I actually believe that if you look at the world, if you look at, I suppose, macro relationships, nations, international affairs, let's say, I think a lot of the conflicts and connections that we see on a global scale originate. The things we learn about relationships and how to handle conflict begin at home. And so I think there's a kernel of family psychology that is within all world relations. I would say that in the past year, some of the best books I have read happen to be books about how different wars have impacted people's lives. And I think there's a lot of important literature out there that helps readers feel and experience what war is like, what it's like to be an immigrant, basically a lot of fiction addresses themes that have to do with, for want of a better word, globalization. And yet still, to write about the most intimate human relationships is just as relevant as writing about what it's like to grow up as an Indian immigrant here, or what it's like to engage in the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, I'm speaking somewhat arbitrarily, but...
Well, I'm sure that our listeners want to hear some of your writing. Could you read a little
for us now? Sure. Let's see. I think I'll read from my most recent book, which is a novel called The Widower's Tale. And it's told from four different points of view, but the main point of view is that of Percy Darling, who's a 70-year-old retired librarian. And I'm going to read...
Percy runs, doesn't he?
Percy is a runner. He's quite vigorous. He's extremely opinionated, as you will learn in this passage I'm going to read. Now, I will say that, you know, people ask where I get my characters from, and I very often write from male points of view, but all my most important characters come out of some nook or cranny in myself, usually some aspect of my personality or my character that I'm not entirely happy about. And Percy definitely grew out of what I would call my inner curmudgeon. So Percy, it reflects in this, he's actually been a widower for 30-some years. And the most important relationships in this book are his relationships with his two grown daughters who are in their 40s and who he raised from the time their mother died when they were teenagers, and his favorite grandson who is an undergraduate at Harvard. So there's a lot of multi-generational relationships here. And it's the first book where I attempted to write about multi-generational relationships from the oldest of the generations. My first book, Three Junes, is about a group of grown siblings who are dealing with the deaths of their parents. So, here is Percy reflecting on what has become of libraries. The profession I chose, like the woman I chose, belongs to the past, except in the minds of those who truly loved it and mourn its tragic demise. Even the educational path upon which it is based has become all but unrecognizable. What was once called library science now has a trend-driven, hocus-pocus name, something like informational studies. A library that is respectably up-to-date is no longer a temple dedicated to the guardianship of books or a sanctuary for the hallowed art of reading. No, a library is a zone of cyber-kinetic values, a brain as viewed by the cold, lizardly pathologist, a numbingly gray place of systems and wiring, of knowledge-related transactions that may or may not, preferably not to many of my grandson's peers, require the use of books. A library is now far more like a bank than like a church or a museum. Cause for rejoicing in the minds of the Orwellian clerks who service its needs. 10 years ago, my town's public library, a cathedral-esque Victorian structure built of red brick, its front door crowned with a stained glass window depicting the warrior scholar Athena, endured a so-called renovation. Perversely, all books were permanently removed from the vaulted central room, the tall shelves replaced by carrels containing internet access stations and bins displaying movie DVDs. The information desk is now manned, womaned, by someone whose main job is to help you reserve time slots for the computers or guide you through the arduous process of logging on. If you do not watch your feet as you pass through this room, you are sure to trip on the electrical cords that creep everywhere like kudzu. Once I blame these changes on the computers themselves. Through my decades at Widener Library, we classified and reclassified volumes again and again, enduring a series of achingly absurd systemic quakes, each christened with yet another acronym from MARC through OCLC to HOLLIS. Walls were ripped open to accommodate more cabling. Throughout our reading rooms, the bitter glow of screens began to clash with lamplight. But such blame is naive, merely another form of condemning the messenger. In retrospect, I am forced to accept that an atheistic passion for the abstract nature of existence, a leaning toward the mathematical, would have led sooner or later to an anti-reverence toward all things bibliographical, a sort of baby with the bathwater ethos. It is no coincidence that the first books were religious in nature, Word of God and all that. Since I stand firmly in the God is for sissies camp, I follow the logic of this evolution with more sorrow than outrage.
How much of what Percy has said to us is how Julia Glass feels about library?
Well, whenever I read that passage, and it goes on into a scene about how he met his wife, which is, I think, a romantic scene, that shows his other side, his very tender romantic side. You know, one is told as a fiction writer never to use your characters as a megaphone for your own viewpoints, but I say, to heck with that, you know.
They're your characters.
Well, that's right, and they'll do whatever I tell them to do. Sue Miller likes to say that. She says her characters are her employees, and they do whatever she tells them to do, and I like that philosophy. So, yes, in that case, Percy is my mouthpiece. And it's funny because I did an event at a library, and I love libraries. You know, I think I love my childhood library that I remember. I worked at my town's public library from fifth grade all the way through college summers, actually. I like to say that my public library was my third parent and kept me out of trouble when I was a teenager. So that part of myself is very much in Percy. But he's also, you know, he's a man of his generation, too. And the one thing that I think is both challenging and delightful to me when I take on a character who's from a different generation than mine, whether that character is an older generation like Percy or a younger generation like his grandson, from whose point of view part of the book is also told, is that it really makes me look at the world intentionally, try to look at the world very differently. And that is the fabrication part of the fiction. You know, it's based in what I know, but I have to go out and seek to see the world differently. And I may read a lot about the times that those characters grew up in, or in the case of his grandson, who's in college. While I was writing this book, I spent a lot of time hanging out in the kitchen of a friend of mine who has three teenage sons who ranged from high school to college, because I don't have people of that age in my life. My children are younger, and I love just eavesdropping on the way, you know, the kind of patter that they had. The way they communicate is almost a completely different language from English. So I have to do a lot of exploring, too. And in fact, characters who are the most like me, same age, same gender, are in a way the hardest to create. Because it's difficult to make yourself be three-dimensional in a fully interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually envy, well, envy's the wrong word, but I'm writers like Dave Sedaris, who take their personal lives, who really write about themselves and their lives, and that's their main form of entertainment. I have written personal essays, but I to make the main material of your writing your own life, I find that fascinating. I have to be making stuff up. I guess I've always been a daydreamer. You know, I was the child that my mother was always yelling at me, stop daydreaming. No, hello. And I still am. You know, I'm thinking, what if? And what would it be like to be someone in this situation, not me, to be a man, to be, you know, a man of a certain generation, to be a gay man? You know, I've written a couple of, I mean, the character that many of my fans love most is Fenno McLeod, who is the protagonist of Three Junes. And he is a gay 40-something Scottish man who runs a bookstore in Greenwich Village. Now, what the part of me that is inside him is that bibliophile, that person who's happy to bury himself alone with books. But his life as a gay man is something I I had to imagine. And I do have a lot of gay friends, but he's not based on any of my particular friends. He's a made-up character.
You've told us some interesting things about your process, that you start from where you know, that you do research, and that you learn as you write. Or do you learn before you sit down to write? What is the actual writing process?
Well, the story always begins with a character. A character in a dilemma at a crossroads, to whom something dramatic has just happened or who's made a dramatic choice. And the story will start, as I like to say, in the middle of the middle, when, you know, at that moment of change, perhaps. And so you go forward, what's going to happen next, but you also go back. Where does the story come from? Where's the foundation of everything? And I'm always interested in, I think every rich character must reveal to the reader, or the writer must reveal to the reader, that character's childhood. Where does that character come from? So I work forward and back with the character's life, and then I think about the character's family, friends, co-workers, pets, as I said. Sometimes pets are kind of important characters in my books. And where does that person live? Where has that person lived? What kind of a home? I love, you know, here's where the visual artist in me comes out. I love creating houses, creating landscapes, the places that to which the character belongs, and that belong to the character. I wondered whether you were alluding to research also when you said, you know, what do I find out? You know, there are times, there are aspects of all my novels that I do have to research. And I'm kind of lazy. I do my research as late as possible. But it's not just because I'm lazy. It's also because I believe in trying to imagine what is correct about something and then go out and correct myself later. I think it's better to follow your instincts. You know, some things that I've had to research in the course of writing my novels, for instance, the pathology and treatment of AIDS in the late 1980s to Three Junes, that was essential. But I wrote based on what I knew from living in that community, from having friends who'd been HIV positive. And then after I finished a draft of the novel, I went to a doctor who was willing to talk to me about those things. And some of it was very difficult. One of the things I wanted to discuss was how doctors help patients end their lives, which is something doctors are not allowed to discuss because, of course, it's against the law, for one thing. So we had to have a very circuitous conversation about it, but it was relevant to the plot of Three Junes. And so I went back, and I had to readjust and change things. But I would rather... right now I'm finishing up a novel in which one of the main characters is a cellist, a very talented cellist. I am not a musician. I wish I were. But by happenstance, one of my students at a writer's workshop a couple of years ago he's writing fiction, beautiful fiction, but he's a professional cellist. And so I'm emailing to him, but I've held off a lot of my questions. Like, this character plays in outdoor concerts at a summer festival, and I wonder, does the heat and humidity affect the instrument? You know, those kind of details. But I'd rather find them out later. I'd rather try to just create from whole cloth the experiences and the worlds of my characters first, and then go out and find out what I got wrong and make it right.
So often we hear research, 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 and I believe what I'm hearing you say is imagine, imagine,
right.
Imagine, and then do the research you need to fill
right.
in the details.
But, you know, it's very interesting because I've met fiction writers who, usually they're writers of historical fiction, for whom that, you know, marinating in history is what they do first. They know they're going to write. I mean, I have a friend who's passionate about the American Revolution, and he's actually written an award-winning novel called The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing that gives a very startlingly different vision of aspects of the American Revolution. But he told me that he just spent months and months before he even started writing that book reading letters, you know, from Minutemen, from militiamen in New England. And for him, it too was imagining. He said, I wanted to know what would it be like to be a young man who was a farmer or a barrel maker who suddenly is called to war. And he's only used his gun to shoot turkeys. you know, what's that like? And what did he think about the cause he was fighting for? We have our, you know, we've been taught certain things in school, but he wanted to go. So he immersed himself in that. And I think, you know, one of my favorite characters of his is a character that he found through reading actual letters. So that's a different way. For some people, the research is the favorite part.
I'm thinking about Percy Darling and and the piece that you read from him, and thinking about also finding the time and space and quiet to imagine. Is that a challenge?
Yes, especially with two little boys. Well, one is not so little. He's 16. He actually would like to leave me in total peace and quiet and have nothing to do with me sometimes. But I talked yesterday, as you know, at the conference about how I think it's not only is it harder and harder to find a quiet place to be alone, but people are so wired and connected all the time that people have lost the important habit of being alone with their own company and nobody else's company. No gadgets, no, you know, no email, no texting. No, though, like Percy, I'm a curmudgeon about modern technology, it's necessary to my life. And I, too, have become an email addict. Sometimes I have to be more deliberate about distancing myself from connections. But I also, for me, a lot of the most important work of imagining happens when I'm out in the world, on my own, shopping, driving, waiting in line to mail a package, walking my dogs, and I make an effort to be unreachable at those. I don't carry my cell phone. I don't take an iPod. And that, you know, you could call it daydreaming, or I like to call it marinating in my characters' lives. It has to happen in solitude, mental solitude, if not literal solitude. In fact, it's more important that that part be solitary than the actual getting it done on the computer. I do have a hard time working if people are talking in the room, but often when I'm at the keyboard, I'm sort of downloading what's already the worlds that have already come to be inside my head.
We'd like to go back into that world inside your head and hear another piece from another of
your All right. Well, I am going to read from my third book, I See You Everywhere, which is actually... It's really a collection of very tightly linked short stories, but it came out in the world without a label, so most critics call it a novel, and I won't argue with that. But it is told, it's about the relationship between two grown sisters in that decade when they are becoming adults, you know, their 20s, basically. And the stories alternate between the two sisters' viewpoints. The older sister, Louisa, is very much like me, and I will say this is the closest to autobiography that my fiction comes. I had a younger sister who is, I'm sad to say, no longer with us. And we were, like a lot of siblings, very, very different, and we didn't get along as children. We were 5 years apart, but
your sisters.
And 5 years is that. My sons are, by coincidence, 5 years apart. That's a tough span between siblings for many reasons. Anyway, we were temperamentally quite different. We didn't hang out together until we were both away from home. And then we discovered what a gift it was to have someone in your life who you'd never meet were you not related by blood. Temperamentally, we were different. My sister was a wildlife veterinarian. And so in this book, Louisa, the older sister, is a... she's actually an art critic. I combined the writing and the painting in my life, too. But I had to do a little research on that, too, what it's like to be an art critic. And Clem, the younger sister, is a biologist. But in the story that... I'm going to read the beginning of the story called Husbandry. And this... It takes place in the year 1986, not that that perhaps matters for the sake of this reading. But this is Clem when she is still getting her PhD in biology, and she's working as a vet tech part-time to support herself through graduate school. Husbandry. I'm on the graveyard shift when my mother calls to tell me that 10 of her prize hounds have been abducted by her kennelman and are, or so she suspects, headed clear across the country to Carmel. Took off, the lunatic. Thinks he can pull a Houdini on me. Well, let me tell you, his notion of cunning is pathetic. She rants on, sharp as she always is when provoked. She has her sources. She's no idiot. She'll track him down and have his hide on toast. Years of trust. Years. And what? What are the man's true colors? A monster. Just a crazed, sadistic monster biding his time. I listen. All I'm permitted to do, which is fine by me. But here's what I know. Titus Goodwin, who's hung around our house for ages, fondly known to us as Titey, hasn't one sadistic atom in his battle-weary soul. And monstrous? No way. Crazy, though, you couldn't rule out. He has a vindictive temper, an appetite for tragedy, and drinks like a camel refueling at an oasis. A bad mix. Otherwise, he's your run-of-the-mill deposed aristocrat who, if scornful of the human race, has nothing but tenderness and reverence for all living creatures, down to the prickliest sea urchin. This is why I will always love Titey, no matter what he does to the people around him. But I have no time for his neuroses or for my mother's fury. There's a cat due here any minute, classic urinary blockage, and it's my job to call in a vet. Look, say they got off at dawn, I say to Mom. They can't be any farther than, what, mid-Ohio, Indiana? Titey'd never break 55 with hounds in the truck. I don't know what you think I can do, but whatever it is, I can't do it till they get here. I live in Monterey, right next to Carmel. I can't imagine how you'd hide 10 restless foxhounds in a town that snug. But Titey's never been rational. Nor has my mother, which may help explain how they've gotten along all these years. Parallel lines that kiss at infinity. Mom is master of the fig tree domain fox hunt. Titey is her kennelman. Go to the police is what you can do, she says. I look at the clock. Her time, it's 2 a.m. My father will be upstairs, long asleep, head clamped under a pillow. Mom will be pacing the kitchen, talking, smoking, sipping vodka, her reflection over the sink goading her on. Mom, listen, I'm afraid we've got an emergency here. Honey, we certainly do. He took Tallulah. She's whelping in less than 2 weeks. Tallulah, a sublimely marked blanket-back crossbred, symmetrical as a Rorschach blot, took best in show last year at Bryn Mawr and gives incomparable tongue. She's my mother's number one brood bitch. Bench queen or mutt, a dog in whelp on the road is bad news, but I tell Mom I have to go. I don't tell her I have no intention of calling the police before I talk to Titey. That is, if he gets this far. Because where would he stay? Your average Motel 6 isn't likely to let a pack of dogs cozy up in their massage-o-matic bed. Nor do I tell her that Louisa will be arriving here tomorrow, having informed my machine 4 hours ago, in a voice jagged with tears, that she's catching a dawn flight from New York, that she's had it with her husband's inertia, and thinks she might leave him. Headlights sweep the parking lot. A car door slams, and then I hear the unmistakable yowling of feline pain. I speed dial the night vet and yank on clean scrubs as I hopscotch my way to the stairs, cordless in hand. I'm halfway down when he answers. "Poos Poos Simonson's here," I tell him. "Roto-Rooter, Major League." I hold out the phone to share the cat's distress, echoing off the tiled floor of our waiting room. Poos Poos, a massive fur-bound coon cat, rides in Mrs. Simonson's arms. Mrs. Simonson begins to cry. I suggest gently that Poos Poos might prefer his carrier, and she bawls, "When this may be his last hour on Earth!" Are the planets out to spite me? Why is everyone suddenly indulging in hysterics? I put my hand on Mrs. Simonson's shoulder and say very softly, "It's okay. Dr. John will be here any minute. Everything's going to be fine, I promise." This calms her down instantly. I don't know why, but people trust me.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've been talking with Julia Glass. She read from I See You Everywhere, her novel from 2008, and earlier from The Widower's Tale, which came out in 2011. And Julia, we're almost out of time, but one quick question. When is the next book?
Oh, I'm hoping to turn in a very big, messy draft to my editor actually at the end of this month. So I'm hoping for next year sometime.
And do you have a title yet?
You know what? I keep titles close for complicated reasons. I'm actually not a very good title person, and usually the title changes. So I have to kind of... All I'll tell you, just as a tease, is that it's a quote from a song that throughout this book, songs, both contemporary and classical songs, are kind of a leitmotif.
All right. So we will remember the name, Julia Glass.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Patty.
This is The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for The Virginia Voice.